Hello and welcome back to the Edge of the Box podcast, a podcast by WhoScored.com in association with Ultimate Fan. I'm your host, Dan Bardell, joined by George Ellick, but first, Jonathan Wilson to preview the weekend's action. We've got FA Cup and Premier League games to look at this week. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Looking forward to talking to you. And George, back, had a bad week in the predictions just before he, and then didn't really want to show your face the week after, it felt like, after getting 3 points. But then now I can't say anything because I only got 1 point.
No way.
Weekend, 1 point.
It was a funny set of results, to be fair.
Well, you say that, but you got 7 and Ali got 7. So, you know, for me to get 1 point, I can't really say, oh, yeah, it was a
funny week.
Last week was a 6-pointer.
Well, it's getting too close now. I was running away with it, and now I am limping towards the finish line. And Jonathan and Sam are now on 166 points with me on 169. So there's no margin for error anymore. George, you've got 140. I'm not too concerned about you.
Well, you're sitting where you are. Who knows? It's like Sunderland in the Championship.
that Luton equaliser against Palace, if that hadn't happened, we'd be joint top.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well done, Luton. That might have been the only one I got right that I had down as a draw. In which case,
I'd be ahead if that was your only point.
I might be wrong there, but I definitely only got a draw right. In I don't know which game it was there, but yeah, it's getting close now. It's like the race for the title, race for top four, relegation battle. It's all getting really, really close at the business end of the season. And I reckon at one point I was about 30 points ahead. To only be 3 points ahead now is disgusting. But anyway, enough about the predictions league. Let's look forward to the weekend's football. And it is, of course, a strange weekend in England as we have the FA Cup and then we have 4 Premier League games as well. We're going to start by focusing on Manchester United v Liverpool in the FA Cup. And Jonathan, really, is this a chance for Ten Hag to save his job if they were to win the FA Cup?
I wouldn't frame it like that. I think whether he wins the FA Cup or not is kind of irrelevant. So it's not 1990 where Alex Ferguson could save his job by winning the FA Cup with a series of single goal victories over lower division sides, which is what he did. But it's also, you know, you look at, say, 2017, where Louis van Gaal won the FA Cup and was literally celebrating on the pitch when the news breaks that Jose Mourinho is going to replace him. So I think the FA Cup itself and winning it doesn't really make that much of a difference. What might make a difference is if they suddenly pull out a really good, memorable performance against Liverpool, that could just persuade fans, Ineos, Jim Ratcliffe, that there is something there. Now, how likely that is, I think, is another question. But you know, I was sort of thinking about this, you know, in terms of the fact that they're playing such a big rival. You look, and you know, I was going to say, I apologise for bringing this back to Sunderland. I don't. I'm just going to bring it back to Sunderland.
We all do it.
We looked at that Sunderland Newcastle game in the third round, and you thought it's a free hit for Sunderland, and that's really dangerous for Newcastle. And actually, it turned out not to be a free hit for Sunderland. One of the reasons that fans turned on Michael Beale was just how timid and how tentative Sunderland were in that game against the Newcastle team, who were on a horrible run of form, who had loads of injuries, who looked vulnerable. And Sunderland offered nothing. And I think, you know, it wasn't immediate, but actually that had a big influence in persuading Sunderland fans, yeah, this guy doesn't get it. He's not for us. So I think conversely, Ten Hag, if somehow United from nowhere pull out a great performance and a great result against Liverpool, that would be a huge plus for him. If a scrapper 1-0, yeah, get pummeled, nick one on the break, and they somehow go on to, yeah, somebody else puts City out and they beat, I don't know, Wolves and Leicester to in the semi and the final, I don't think that makes any difference to his job. I think the winning of a trophy is less relevant than how well they play in this game. And say they played City in a later round, then that obviously could have a huge impact as well.
George, can you see that happening? Can you see them playing well, or do you think it will be a similar kind of setup as they went for against Manchester City? I know that was an away game. Can you see him doing that at home, Old Trafford, against Liverpool?
I don't know how much of a say they get, really, in terms of the way that they approach the game in possession. I think Liverpool will dictate and will dominate to an extent. Like, they might try and engage Liverpool further up the pitch, but I just don't think they're good enough necessarily to try and actually control any phases of play within Liverpool's half, unless Liverpool allow them to. Like, I just think there's a big gap between these sides right now. I mean, what I will caveat that with is that United have got a knack, and have had a knack over the last decade or so, of underperformance, of pulling out results in big games when you wouldn't necessarily expect them to. That's why their record against Manchester City is way better than you would think it would be under Pep. And through that, there's kind of some doubt for me sitting here and saying, well, you know, I expect Liverpool to win this game 3 or 4-0. But having said that, there's still, you know, you look at the performance that Liverpool put in against Manchester City last time out. You look at the way Liverpool are playing right now, just relentless attacking pressure. And for Manchester United, even in games where they, from an attacking point of view, they look like they're performing a little bit better than what we're used to, they're still conceding so many chances, consistently conceding so many shots. Yeah, when you look at this, you know, it's all well and good saying, how do we think Erik ten Hag's going to approach this game? I think he's the only way he really can approach, even if the Manchester United fans don't really like it, is to respect the quality that Liverpool have. Otherwise, they'll get absolutely mauled.
Well, yeah. That game at Anfield earlier in the season, yeah, I know United are the only team to have stopped Liverpool scoring this season, but that's not a model of how you can play against them. No. I mean, Liverpool had 34 shots.
Mm.
You know, I know, okay, Liverpool lost a little bit of discipline in that game. We're taking on shots from crazy distances, crazy angles by the end. But still, if Liverpool have 34 shots against them again, at least one and probably 3 or 4 are going to go in. So you can't say, oh yeah, Ten Hag worked it out early in the season. He got lucky early in the season. And maybe he gets lucky again, or maybe he works out a different way of doing it that's more effective. But that's not a template for how you play against Liverpool.
No, not at all. I mean, to be fair, 34 shots that day. I mean, it's been the tale of, I know they haven't quite been to that extreme, but in most games they're conceding around 23-24 shots.
It's 198 shots in the last 10 games, but that includes games against Forest, Luton and Newport.
Didn't Newport scored as well, didn't they?
Twice,
yeah. It's not good, is it? It's not anything. You can dress all these stats around Manchester United at the moment, but whatever comes out the back end of it never seems pleasant. George, I'm going to do some Jurgen Klopp style management with you here, George. I'm really liking what you're saying. I've got a feeling that the audio is not coming through where it should come.
Yeah, so mate, it's bad news, this. I spoke because you were actually late on the call, so you missed this. But I managed to leave my AirPods and my microphone together in the kitchen and at home. So that's why it's coming through, whatever it's coming through, which I think is just quite a bad earphone mic.
It's not terrible, but it's not as good as it should be. I was going to ask Jonathan a question and then see if you could do some work behind the scenes. But no, you've explained it. That's fine. I don't mind. It's not bad. And I'm enjoying what you're saying anyway. George. Thank you. Jonathan, Mo Salah's back, which is, you know, a great boost for Liverpool. Probably not what Manchester United wanted to hear. He's obviously going to have a big say in how many trophies Liverpool win at the back end of this season, how far they go in the title challenge. Do you want to have a stab at his three most favourite opponents to play against in terms of goal scored?
United.
Yep, that's one. And top with 12.
City.
Yep, 11. Have you got this in front of you?
No, just clever. And it's got to be somebody who's been in the Premier League for quite a long time. They've played a lot of games against, maybe played them in cups as well.
Yeah, this is all competitions, I should say.
Everton?
No, they're not even in the top 10, actually, Everton. George, really? I'm going to let you in with a guess.
Spurs?
Yes, Spurs third with 11. He's also scored 11 against West Ham and 10 against Arsenal. So when it's the big guy, he's playing against the so-called big six. He turns up, doesn't he, Jonathan?
He does. I'm not sure he'll start this game, actually. I thought he didn't. Well, it's just, if you're Liverpool, if you're Klopp, and you know you've got, you know, what 8 games left in the league, you know this is a United side you probably should beat anyway. So you've got the semi-final and the final of the FA Cup. You know, they're clearly going to go through in the Europa League. If you're, I think it's probably a game where you leave him on the bench and you give him half an hour at the end just to get his fitness up. I didn't think he looked particularly fit against City last week. I know he played that great through ball just after coming on, but I thought actually after that he looked slightly off it. So I just don't think there's any need to risk him in this game. Or maybe you do the opposite and you give him sort of 55 minutes at the start. But I'd be surprised if he goes much more than an hour in this game. But getting him back, he's such a consistent goal scorer. He's such a regular threat. Of course, it's huge for Liverpool. But one of the benefits of him being out is that we've seen other players come into that forward line look very good. And yeah, Harvey Elliott's played really well. And the fact he can play midfield or in that forward line is really useful for Liverpool. So, yeah, they've got plenty of options. They're not in a position where they have to rush him back, and I don't see why they would.
Yeah, and George, Alex McAllister's on good form as well. Obviously scored the penalty in the last game against Manchester City. But earlier on in the season, they were kind of having to play him as a number six. The fact that they've got Endo there now has freed McAllister up. Have you been impressed with him a little bit higher up the pitch?
Yeah, super impressed. It's interesting, though, that in the last kind of week or so, it feels like they've changed a little bit in the way that they're using McAllister. Not just as... I think the setup has changed a bit, where it's not necessarily just McAllister and Szoboszlai either side of Endo. Certainly in the Europa League a week ago, in that dominant win, it was more kind of Endo and McAllister sitting off, with Szoboszlai kind of playing more like a kind of attacking eight, but through the middle rather than on the side. And against City, it was very much a case where Endo and Rodri were kind of both the anchors. But naturally, because it was Manchester City they were playing against, Alexis played a bit deeper. So it'll be interesting to see what role he does take up here. He's just an unbelievable player. Like, there are so few footballers in my mind who do what he does in terms of being able to play so many different roles. He can play, you know, whatever number you want to use to describe your midfielder, from 10, 8 and 6, he can do all three of them and in any way as well as an attacking option and defensive. And that is a pretty incredible skill set. He's also an unbelievable penalty taker, as we've seen in Mo Salah's absence too. So, yeah, a quality player and an amazing signing. Certainly when you look at the two midfielders taken out of Brighton last summer, the deal to get McAllister out of there rather than Caicedo. Not that was necessarily Liverpool's choice, but it's aged pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, it was 35 million as well, wasn't he, McAllister? That is a bargain in the modern day.
The other thing I like about him, I mean, I was in Utah roughly this time last year doing some lecturing, and was one of the students sort of said, "Oh, you know, if the US took soccer seriously, we'd be the best in the world." And he listed sort of the stats of all these sort of basketball players, American football players, 6'5", weighs whatever, can sprint whatever and whatever. And my response to him was, the three best players in history of football are 5'7", 5'8", and 5'10". Yeah, height and physique just doesn't matter. And McAllister is a great example of that. If you look at him physically, like, he's clearly very, very fit. Don't get me wrong. By normal standards, he's very, very fit. But by athlete standards, he's not exceptional at all. He's a sort of average height, average pace, average build. But his technique, his reading of the game, his understanding of the game are all absolutely exceptional. And I think one of football's great strengths as a sport is that while pace and strength clearly can help, do help, actually what marks out the very good from the absolute best is that mentality, that vision, that capacity to work out which bit of technique to use at which points. It's not necessarily just physique. And I think he's a great example of somebody who's got that in spades and physically is not exceptional.
Yeah, worth saying at this point that Dr. Jonathan Wilson is available on the lecturing circuit, and also he will be appearing in a new podcast soon, Wilson's Lists. Watch out for Wilson's List on all podcast platforms. So just on Alexis McAllister, a bit like Luka Modric. In the way you've described it, if I'd have not known who you were talking about then, I would have said, oh, he's talking about Luka Modric there. McAllister.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously is physically slightly more impressive than Modric, but yeah. It's a similar thing you know when before a game when you play, I don't know if you still play, but no. if I was playing you, you'd be walking to the pitch, you'd be looking at the opposition, you'd think, oh Christ, he's massive, oh God, he looks quick, oh, I'm a bit scared of him. And then the game starts, and actually they're not necessarily the best players at all. And if you saw Luka Modric, if you wander up to a park pitch and you saw Luka Modric, and you obviously if he didn't look like Luka Modric, but had the same physique as Luka Modric, you'd be like, oh yeah, he'd be fine, just knock him off the ball. And then you start playing within 5 minutes, you'd be like, oh Christ, this guy is brilliant. And I think that that is one of the great things about football, that that a Modric, a Xavi would be another example. Again, Alexis McAllister is clearly physically slightly more imposing than either of them. But yeah, it's reading of a game, selection of pass, technical ability is what actually matters.
In that analogy, I'm the person who's 6 foot one and the people turn up and say, oh, he's big. And then they realise from kickoff, he's rubbish. That's who I am in that analogy. George, let's talk about Jarrell Kwanzaa. League One last season, not particularly highly rated, but performing well in the Premier League for Liverpool. Explain, please.
Yeah, it was a weird one. I mean, there are two players currently lighting it up for Liverpool who were playing their trade in League One last season, because Conor Bradley was at Bolton. We've spoken about him, and when Conor Bradley was at Bolton, he was one of the best players in League One and looked like he was playing just well beneath his level. With Kwanzaa, it wasn't really the case. Like, he turned up at Bristol Rovers at the back end of January. He was sent off in a 2-0 defeat against Pompey at home. And generally, they didn't really rate him. Now, when I watch Kwanzaa for Liverpool, he looks like the perfect Premier League centre-back, because he's just so calm and confident on the ball. And he's rapid. So it means that when you play a high line, he's very good at turning and defending his goal, running back to goal. And he's also just incredibly comfortable in possession. So whether those two things don't necessarily translate to League One football is probably the case. You also have to factor in that he was being managed by Joey Barton, which I think is probably a difficult thing for anyone to have to deal with. I'd be lying if, as someone who follows the EFL pretty closely, I said that I saw Jarrell Kwanzaa going from his loan spell at the Memorial last season to starting as being discussed as a possible starter, even without injuries at Liverpool. But it's horses for courses. It's a very different skill set maybe needed to be a defender in League One, whereas at Liverpool, where maybe you're not tested in the same way physically, but your technical skills can flower, and that's what we're seeing.
Jarrod Branthwaite's been speculated for an England call-up later on today, Jonathan. I think he was at PSV last season on loan, so obviously had a loan at a higher level last season and has broken into the Everton team this season. I think Kwanzaa, with the injuries, is unlucky to not be being talked about, or would that be too much of a jump at this stage?
I mean, I'd be surprised if he's not at least in Southgate's thoughts. I guess he hasn't quite got the body of evidence behind him that Branthwaite has. I guess Southgate, I think, likes a centre-back who is big and strong and wins headers. I think he still sees that at international level as being very important, which is why he's been so loyal to Harry Maguire. What he said about Maguire is, whatever else you want to criticise him for, you put a ball in the box and the likelihood is Maguire gets his head in it. And I think that type of defending is more necessary at international level than maybe the top end of the Premier League or the Champions League. But I guess ideally you want a pair, don't you? You want the big strong bloke who wins the headers, and you want the quick bloke who can mop up behind him and can distribute. I guess John Stones has got that role sewn up for England, so maybe that's why Kwanzaa is not in. I mean, he may well be in the squad, we don't know yet, but why he's not been talked about more loudly. But I think there's also, and it's a totally reasonable sense of, England have been here before. England went through this phase up to about 2000 or 95, where you had to have played for 5 years to be anywhere near the England squad. England never picked kids. And then suddenly under Ericsson, because of the example of Michael Owen, I guess, he was given a start by Glenn Hoddle. We're only going to pick kids, because as soon as Wayne Rooney showed a sniff of talent, bring him in. Theo Walcott, bring him in. And I don't think that's really, I mean, with Rooney, it was fine, but I don't think it did Walcott any good. So when there are other options, I'm not really sure it makes sense to sort of overbroach kids too quickly. He's clearly now in the conversation. I think over the next 3 or 4 years, it'd be surprising if he didn't make squads and then maybe become a regular.
I'm not sure he's even played for the under-21s yet. I'm assuming he hasn't. I'd need to look.
I'm going to say 3 caps, but let me just look that up.
Okay.
He's definitely played England youth level. I don't. Maybe not. Yeah. Three caps, yes. Thank you.
For under-21s, okay, so he has played for the under-21s. Yeah. Southgate likes that route, doesn't he, of players having played in the under-21s. I remember tweeting a few months ago when I was watching a Liverpool game, tweeting, I don't know what it is, but Jarrell Kwanzaa has it, because I just really, really liked the look of him that day in the game that I watched. Let's talk about Manchester United then, George. Let's go back to them. No Hoyland still. Been playing a bizarre setup, almost like a 4-2-4 without Hoyland. Really, they won against Everton at the weekend, but my God, it was a poor game. Two penalties. What have you made of that system?
Not much. I feel like Eric Ten Hag watched our show and heard us chatting about how you should never play Marcus Rashford up front and panicked and thought, okay, well, I don't have anything else to do. I don't really know. I mean, it doesn't seem to make them a much better attacking side. At least it enables Rashford to play off the left. At least it enables Scott McTominay to play this kind of Marouane Fellaini role where he's effectively
the fact you're even calling it that, like that's a throwback to successful times.
No, I mean, I know.
You're right, but it's just like the fact we're even talking about it like that.
But like that is, I mean, for McTominay now, frankly, he offers nothing in possession, I wouldn't say. Like he's competent on the ball, like he can retain possession pretty well. He's not a creative passer. He's not someone who can progress the ball through the lines. He doesn't really touch the ball when he's playing in the system with Casemiro and Bruno in there. His job is just to run fast into the box when Garnacho's got the ball on the right-hand side and delivers crosses in, which, you know, he's unbelievable at finding space and timing his runs and scoring goals. And right now, you said they're playing without a striker. I think they're just playing with a very unorthodox striker in McTominay, because his job is there to score goals and get on the end of crosses, which is, you know, maybe a different definition of a front man. But, you know, it doesn't look particularly innovative to me. I guess they can crowd the midfield a bit here and try and frustrate Liverpool in possession, which might help. And then when they break on the counter, they should have the legs to get a man forward. But at the same time, you want someone engaging the Van Dijk and Quanta or whoever else it is on the ball. So, I think the sooner Hoyland can come back, the better.
Well, I think what they tried to do against City was sort of a 4-3-1-2, but the two quite split, which is not unlike how Solskjaer used to often set up against big teams. And I'm not wholly against that. It makes sense that the strength is the pace of Rashford and Garnacho. And if you can get them hitting the awkward channels between the fullback and the centre-back, or if a fullback over advances, which can be an issue, certainly on the right for Liverpool, that does make some kind of sense. I think where it's gone wrong is that, for whatever reason, Bruno Fernandes is getting sucked too far forward. And then Scott McTominay, who should be making runs from deep, if you want to say he's playing on the right of the three, but making runs from deep to get in the box late, which is what he is good at. That sort of is one of those things that makes sense in theory, but in practice it does. He always ends up, he seems to be not starting deep enough. So he's not making the run from deep. He's too high to start with. I think because that sort of hole opens up and he sort of feels sort of he has to fill it. So my feeling in the City game was it wasn't the wrong plan. It just wasn't executed particularly well. And you could see moments where they had the ball about to break and there was this sort of hesitation. It wasn't natural to them. They hadn't practiced it enough. And given the injuries, I was sort of prepared to be fairly generous about that. And then you see them trying to do it against Everton. You know, well, Everton don't play like City in any way. Everton are going to give you the ball. How's this ever going to work against a team that doesn't give you the ball? How's this ever going to work against a team that is happy for you to have the ball? You know, what you need is to win the ball back and then hit the space behind them. Well, against Everton, that's never going to happen. They got lucky against Everton. The two sort of panicky challenges and Garnacho give them two penalties, but they didn't really create much beyond that. Now, Liverpool, I guess, are more akin to City in that Liverpool will dominate possession. You can expect them to have 60%, maybe more of the ball. So maybe it does sort of make sense, but it has to be more of that 4-3-1-2 with McTominay making deep runs rather than McTominay getting dragged forward, Bruno Fernandes getting dragged forward. And you could see a Rashford on form, which is obviously he's not, creating problems in behind Alexander-Arnold or Bradley or whoever plays it right back.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be, I just can't see anything for Manchester United in this game. In fact, I'm going to introduce a new little game for us to play. Let's play Manchester United Shots Against Bingo. How many shots against them do you reckon that they'll be this weekend, Jonathan?
27,
George?
I think 23 because Liverpool go ahead early.
Okay, I'll go 25. I think this is a game that we can play every week, just for fun. Just take away from the pressure of the predictions league. We just play this little game just for fun every week. How many shots will be against Manchester United? Do you want to have a guess how many Manchester United players are in the combined 11, George?
Two,
Jonathan.
I mean, we know one will be there.
Well, yeah, you're correct on that.
Well, who's that? Bruno Fernandes?
No, the keeper.
Oh, really?
We always
in. He's in. He's in combined. We could do a combined 11 for Arsenal and Chelsea, and Onana would be in goal. He's in every Who's Got Team that is in existence.
I'll say two, Onana and Fernandes.
You're both right because George said two, and then you're right because it is two, Jonathan, and they're the two players that are in the 11. I'm shocked to see Bruno Fernandes in there.
Yeah, but again, the algorithm loves him.
Yeah, I suppose he scored a penalty last week, didn't he? I think Garnacho's unlucky not to be in here. And honestly, he's a sensational watch, Garnacho.
Ahead of through. Who though? Like Garnacho ahead of
Salah.
He has. Garnacho, he scores goals. If you watch him, he's a very pleasant watch. I'm not saying he's better than Diaz, but I'm surprised in terms of his goal output that he's not. I don't know what his rating is, but I'm surprised he's not. He must be close to Diaz to be in this 11, I would say. I'm just trying to think like the algorithm as well. Let me rattle through the 11. We've got Onana in goal. We then got a right back, the highest rated player in this 11, Connor Bradley with 7.58. The centre backs are Konate and Van Dijk with Robertson at left back. Midfield is McAllister, Szoboszlai and Bruno Fernandes. And then a Liverpool centric front three with Salah, Nunes and Diaz leading the line. I mean, if you were picking an 11, that probably wouldn't be too far away from that. Bearing in mind you can't have Alisson in at the moment.
No, but yeah, I don't want McAllister as the deepest line midfielder. I want him alongside a tackler. So I have Endo in there ahead of Fernandes.
Okay, fair enough. I've been told that Garnacho's rating is 6.80. So actually he's 0.16 away from Luis Diaz. But yeah, I love watching Garnacho. I think he's the only thing that's nice about watching Manchester United at the moment, apart from them trying to have the throwback to Marouane Fellaini in midfield with Scott McTominay. We're not going to do predictions for this one, but we're going to predict who we think is going to go through. So I'm imagining it's a Liverpool three-way for us. Yeah. Everyone Liverpool? Yeah, Liverpool go straight through. I thought it would be. Before we look at Fulham v Tottenham in the Premier League, let's do our predictions for the other three games in the Premier League this weekend. And I have gone very away-centric with my predictions. Burnley against Brentford, George.
I've got 1-1.
1-1. I've gone for 2-1 to Brentford. Jonathan?
I have gone 2-1 Brentford, but I do wonder. I ummed and ahed between 1-1 and 2-1, and I've gone to 2-1 Brentford.
Okay, very good. Same as me. Luton Forest, I've gone for 3-1 away win to Forest. And then we put these predictions in before last night to ludicrous football. Jonathan?
1-1. The biggest 1-1. Luton Forest game since the 1959 FA Cup final.
Lovely, lovely work. George?
I don't understand. I can't. Forest are favourites for this game. I can't work out at all. I've got Luton 2-0. I think Luton win this game comfortably.
So, hopefully they don't go 3-0 up.
Yeah, but even last night, like we saw what Luton are about. Like I think they were just a far better team over the last 10 games or so.
It's all about results business, though, George.
Yeah, the results as well.
I know, but
the results have been better.
You can't be throwing away 3-goal deficits. You just can't do that. No, you can't do. You can't be doing that. Right, West Ham v Villa. I'm intrigued with what you two will go for this, Jonathan.
2-1 Villa.
2-1 to Villa. I'm not confident, George.
1-1.
Yep, I've gone for 1-1 as well. I've been predicting Villa to win. I predicted Villa to win last week, and obviously
I think it's been every week, isn't it?
No, I don't always predict to win. I do throw draws in there every now and again, George. I don't just predict Villa to win. And now we're going to talk about Fulham against Spurs. I mean, I watched Spurs last week, George, live in the flesh. Unfortunately, they're a very good team. Play some nice football. Got some very, very interesting players, and the way they set up, I think, fair play to them. They're a good side.
Yeah, they're a very good side. I think to go to Aston Villa and to to win the game. I mean, they were fairly clinical. It wasn't like it was a completely one-sided performance, especially 11-11. But and almost you could argue in the reverse, especially in the first half. Yeah. Spurs, you know, that was probably the most dominant Spurs have been over Villa at any point in the season. And again, they didn't come away with a win. But yeah, here they were very good, and it kind of feels like things have maybe just calmed down a bit, I guess. Like
injuries have certainly calmed down. That was a wrong time to play Spurs because they had pretty much everyone there.
But yeah, that but also just their games were so frenetic for a period. And, you know, you've got two teams here. I mean, Villa's games at home especially also fairly hectic and crazy. Yet in the first half, this felt like a bit of a chess match, like a bit of a non-event. Neither team created too many opportunities. But obviously the second half was a very different case with Maddison and Brennan Johnson with a quick 1-2, putting Spurs ahead. And then John McGinn seeing red, literally and figuratively.
Yellow card.
I thought that was harsh. What did you think, Dan?
I thought it was red.
Did you actually think it was harsh?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I think it was one of the worst challenges I've ever seen. One of the most blatant red cards in the history of football.
I loved how you started your tweets about it with just saying no bias, as if you're the person who can choose.
That was slightly tongue-in-cheek, the no bias comment. Slightly tongue-in-cheek, yes. Well, obviously I know I'm biased because I'm a Villa fan. I genuinely didn't think it was a red. I think it was close.
But there's an issue to this, which is I would agree with you that often, sometimes you see those challenges which are like completely cynical. Absolutely no interest in playing the ball whatsoever. He's not late. It's just a cynical challenge, not given because there aren't studs up or there aren't, you know, it's not clattering into the knee. When, you know, running at full pelt and being completely wiped out deliberately should just absolutely always be a red card.
See, my argument is because he's nowhere near the ball and had no chance of playing the ball, it's actually not serious foul play. It's violent conduct. I think that's no different than walking up and punching him. He's just kicked him. There's no attempt to play the ball and therefore it's violent conduct.
That's a great point. Like, what if the ball wasn't there? What would he say then?
Yeah. Oh, then it would be a red card.
Do that on the street, and you're spending the night in prison, aren't you?
So. Well, my other argument for it was, and this is admittedly a slightly futile and weak argument, but if he had have got a yellow card, I don't think VAR would have said, no, you need to send him off for violent conduct there.
Then VAR would have been wrong, not for the first time this season.
Well, they're wrong quite frequently, aren't they? But that's just my opinion. And I still think, like, the Brighton tackle, the Mulder tackle against Forest, something that's worse than what McGinn did, and he only got a yellow card.
But yeah, just because, like, other people have got things wrong. I mean, it's I can't believe we're debating this. It's not a debate. It's just sort of
talking about it.
Yeah, we should.
The shade of red has not yet been defined. That is as red as that red card was. It's the reddest red in the history of red.
Okay.
Let's
have some respect for Spurs here. We shouldn't be talking about here to talk about Tottenham Hotspur. Let's have some respect, please. Van de Ven went off injured in that game, Jonathan. Tottenham are an infinitely better side with him. He is incredible, by the way. I thought he was incredible anyway from watching him on TV this season when I saw him in the flesh. Jeez, he's quick. Like, he just dealt with Watkins and Bailey, and that seemed to be Villa's game plan, which seemed strange to try and get him behind the quickest player in the Premier League. But I also thought, you know, when he went off, okay, there could be a chance for Villa to get at Tottenham here. Dragosin came in and he looked quite athletic as well. So, you know, before they'd have had to have dropped in Ben Davies, I'm guessing. Having Dragosin, who can now cover both of those centre-backs, it's a good little option to have.
Oh, and they needed to strengthen that position. I mean, yeah, Eric Dier obviously is now gone, but he would have been somebody earlier in the season. They might have brought in Emerson Royals, played there. But yeah, they needed another centre back. Dragosin looks very, very good. Looks very competent. He's clearly quick, which is important. And Van de Ven's a slightly odd player. I when I saw him earlier in the season, you know, just watching somebody warm up, you think he didn't really look like a footballer. He was something sort of slightly ungainly about him. And you know, I was sitting next to Barney Ronnett at the time. We were looking and going, it's not right. This isn't going to work. Then 10 minutes in the game, I was like, oh, hang on. It turns out he is actually just really, really good. And he's just a weird collection of height and pace that you don't often see. Now, I don't know if that ungainliness, if there's a reason why it looks weird to us, and that means that it is weird and that will lead to injuries. The fact that he's now had two similar injuries this season, or whether he's just been unlucky. But yeah, when he's fit, when he's playing, he's an exceptional player because he's so good in the air and he's so quick.
Yeah, they've lost 12 of 18 games. I've completely read that wrong. Awful. Sorry, they've won 12 of 18 games with him in the team. Without him in the team, they've won 4, drawn 4, and lost. Oh, I can't even work this graphic out. I can't even work it out. Sack me. That's right. So without him, they've won 4, drawn 1, and lost 4 in 9 games. With him, won 12, drawn 4, lost 2. So they're a better team with Van de Ven in. Although I will say when he was out, they did have other players out as well, which may like kind of scatter the statage a little bit. But you know, that was pretty much their best 11 at the weekend, other than Richarlison, maybe you could argue, George. But I think the thing is with Tottenham as well, they've just got some unique players. Look at Van de Ven, as we've just discussed. Porro at right back. He's absolutely brilliant. He'd be in the team of the season for me. If I was picking an 11, best 11 of the Premier League season, I think Pedro Porro would be in there. And they're bringing on players as well, bringing on Bentancur in that game. They've just got a good collection of players now, Spurs, haven't they?
It's a lovely case of, and I could do this with Bolton this week. It's a nice case of a guy's team has been beaten 4-0, and now he's just going to praise all their players and say what a good side they are. I think I was saying these things anyway. I was about to say, I feel like Pedro Porro's had more kind of nice words said about him on this podcast than the other player this season. I agree. If you think what a mess Spurs seemed last season, and they felt so far away from being a functioning football team, I think this is just a sign of what, you know, a good, positive coach who comes in, can put an arm around a couple of players who maybe aren't performing particularly well, can add a couple of additions. But there's a fixation now on transfer windows being the most important way of changing a club's fortunes. Whereas actually, if you're not performing particularly well, the chances are there are players within your squad who are underperforming for a reason, and you can turn that around. And it feels the case. You know, obviously, Bentancur has had massive injury problems, but his return has been huge. I think Porro came in last season and looked good, but you know what's happened this season, I don't think anybody necessarily expected. That is, I say it so often, but that's the measure for me of an effective good manager, is when they can take a group of players and elevate their performance level. And that's what Postecoglou's done. And now you look through their squad and it feels pretty stacked. It feels like they've got strength and depth and there aren't injuries. And going into this summer, like, what do they need? I mean, they need a striker, you think, but that there aren't sweeping changes that need to be made in order to make them or to keep them improving. So, I think it all comes down to Postecoglou and what a brilliant job he's done.
He's a brilliant manager. As we know, anyone can get beat by Tottenham on any given day. It could happen to any team, one of the best teams in the Premier League, Tottenham Hotspur. Are they now the favourites for fourth, Jonathan? They have got to play the top three still, but then so are Villa. So they've got that game in hand, which is Chelsea away, not a happy hunting ground for Tottenham. But off the back of that big victory, do you make them now the favourites for fourth?
I think probably yes. I mean, Villa's home form, which was such a big factor early in the season, that seems to have gone.
Yeah.
At the same time, they have picked up away, which is why I think that's why I've gone from to get a result against West Ham at the weekend, get a win at West Ham. I still think it's going to be tight because I don't still fully trust Tottenham, but I think at the moment, you can't say anything other than Tottenham are playing better. And that game, it's not just, it's, you know, the sort of 6-point swing, it's the goal difference swing as well. To put 4 past them is a big issue. And Villa might find themselves in a slightly odd position later in the season with the coefficient, that they're miles ahead of United in 6th, so they know they're going to finish top 5, but they're adrift of Spurs, and so their focus then has to become on the Conference League, partly because it'd be nice to win a European competition, but partly to rack up the coefficient points to make sure that the top 5 in England do get in the Champions League next season. So they almost sack off the Premier League to, you know, make sure that line is drawn under the 5th rather than under the 4th by winning the Conference League.
The two Italian teams going out has helped, hasn't it? They've both gone out.
All three Italian teams. Lazio had already gone out, but yeah.
Yeah, two in the knockout.
And you could do with West Ham doing you a favour against Freiburg.
Yeah.
Because Italy are significantly ahead of both Germany and England. Germany are the ones who are in range of England. Now, Dortmund going through, obviously, I mean, fairly straightforward game against PSV, although they struggled in the second half. I'm not sure Dortmund are going to go much further than Champions League, whereas I think City, certainly, it depends on the draw, obviously, but City and Arsenal, I think you'd fancy them to keep going. But I think tonight, I mean, I don't know when people are going to be listening to this, but Europa League, Conference League, there could be a lot of blood on the carpet tonight. with Brighton probably almost certainly going out.
Yeah.
Villa under a bit of pressure against Ajax, and West Ham 1-0 down against Freiburg. If those three go out, it makes it much harder.
God, don't scare me. I'm obviously going to that game tonight. It is important, actually, the Conference League. You're right. If Villa do finish fifth, it is important for them to try and go all the way in the Conference League. Let's talk a little bit about Fulham then, George. We've got Rodrigo Muniz up front at the moment. Felt like he was scoring every week, and then I put him in my fantasy football team and he decided he didn't want to score like last week. Broja, of course, is on the bench. There's some murmurs around the fact that they kind of need to play Broja because they'll have to pay Chelsea money if they don't. Playing? What do you make?
It's not just murmurs, is it? Like I think they have to start picking him. Or they owe 4 million. I think that's how it is.
They won't want to do that, will they? But maybe Mooney's strikes me as the type of player that could play in a front three and not necessarily have to be the number nine, George.
Possibly. I mean, he's got a bit of pace on him for his frame. He does seem to me like an out and out striker ideally, but we've seen more awkward. Strikers being shoveled out wide in recent times. What a nightmare deal that is from Fulham to bring in a player where if you don't play them, you have to pay that kind of fee. I think for once we can probably give Chelsea a bit of credit there for managing to pull off that deal. Muniz has obviously come in and done very well. Broja's a player that I like. He's obviously been physically, he's had his issues, had a lot of injury problems. It's not that rare, I guess, for a January signing to come in and be eased into action. You know, we spoke about Dragosin earlier as being an example of that. Like, it's unless you have a pressing need, you know, it's probably better to bring the player, let them acclimatise, let them understand what's required of them in their new role. And you know, at the moment, Fulham don't have that need because of Muniz's form. So it's good for them to have options up front. But for the reasons you guys just mentioned, I guess we'll probably see Broja come in fairly soon and maybe Muniz not scoring for your fantasy football team might provide that opportunity here.
That was an interesting pronunciation at the end there.
Munich,
I like it.
He's Brazilian though, isn't he? It's Munich.
It's the harsh Munich. Yeah. I was actually testing Jonathan there. It was good that he
You wouldn't like to do that in front of Tim Vickery. He would have pulled you up immediately for getting that wrong.
Because I think it's also Broja when he pronounced it. I think
we've been told it's Broja. We were told in the summer, because obviously we spoke about him a lot on Sky in January. We were told 100% it's Broja.
Really? Because when he says it, there seems to be a sh sound in it, but maybe that's some kind of pronunciation. The other thing with Broja, I don't know if you've noticed this trend in the this season of Silent Witness that loads of Fulham players are getting mentioned. One of the scriptwriters is a Fulham fan, and so he keeps on dropping it. I mean, actually, weirdly with Broja, he was still at Chelsea at the time, so it's coincidence he's gone to Fulham. But there's an Albanian character who was called Broja. There's also there's some kind of expert was brought in, was called Harrison Kearney. A Silent Witness full of little Fulham references there.
The Jack Reacher novels, the guy who writes that, I don't know his name, he's a Villa fan, and he inserts Villa references and names like that into the Jack Reacher books as well. So I think it's quite a common thing in that kind of world. What's not common, Jonathan? I watched Fulham.
Great segue.
Thank you. It's not common. It isn't common that I watch Fulham on a weekend, but I watched Fulham at Wolves on Saturday, and they got beat. Although I think they played well. I think Marco Silva is an exceptional manager for getting the best out of players. But it was bizarre because it was Lukic and Reid in central midfield, even though Paulinho, who's one of my favourite players in the Prem, is back. Surely he comes back in now. Or do you think this is maybe them starting to think, I don't think he's going to be here next season. We need to try something else.
I mean, you never quite... you never quite know just how fit players are when they're coming back. I think it's not the worst thing in the world to sort of say to you, you know, the player who everybody says is the best player in your squad, who everybody expects to leave, yeah, actually, you know, we can cope without you. And Fulham have shown... Yeah, I thought they'd struggle without Mitrovic, and Muniz has done really well in a very sort of Mitrovic-y way, how he plays. So the fact that Fulham can find a future beyond Paulinho, I think, is very positive for them. And, you know, it's never good to be over-reliant on one player that as soon as he's sort of 60, 70% fit, he gets shoved in. So, yeah, whether he comes back this week, whether they give it another week or two, I mean, he clearly is going to come back sooner rather than later. I think it's a positive thing for Fulham going forward that they're perhaps beginning to show that they don't need him.
Predictions for this one then, please, George.
I think this is going to end 3-1 to Spurs.
And that's exactly the same as what I've predicted. Jonathan?
I've got 2-1 to Spurs.
2-1 to Spurs. Jonathan licking his lips that me and you are going for the same, bearing in mind we've got 4 points between us in the last 2 times that we've predicted. So Jonathan could well find himself top of the league at the weekend. And just for a little bit of fun now, we're going to pick a team to progress from the FA Cup quarterfinals, although I can't see that any of us are going to come up with anything different unless George throws in an EFL one in here. Wolves, Coventry, is anyone not going for Wolves? He wants to. He wants it. George wants it. Lots of injuries for Wolves. Gary O'Neill not on the touchline.
Mark Robbins, an FA Cup specialist as a player. Yeah.
Coventry, I've said it.
You're going Cov? Well done. Well done, George. Because I think we're all probably going for Manchester City at home to Newcastle, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Chelsea, Leicester. Anyone? Any EFL specials there, George?
No, Chelsea. Leicester do not need. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but they don't need this. Like, they need to make sure they get promoted this season because they're looking like they might throw that away.
They've also won the FA Cup recently. Don't be greedy, Leicester. I will say Chelsea felt very much like a cup team this season as well, haven't they? Obviously, get to the Carabao Cup final, and then United. Liverpool.
Oh, sorry. I tell you, Chelsea were pretty good, I thought, against Newcastle on Monday. Just a weird moment of sloppiness at the end, which sort of made it a bit tenser than it should have been. But I know Newcastle aren't a great time.
They can't defend. It's the opposite of last season. They just cannot defend Newcastle.
But weird. Nicholas Jackson, I think, is starting to look the player he ought to be. So
I could do without that with some of the stuff I've said in the press.
Too late.
Yeah, I've already said it. United, Liverpool all went for Liverpool, didn't we, earlier on in the show. Right then, that does us. Thank you very much for joining me today, chaps. A pleasure, as always, to converse with you both. Thank you to everyone for listening or watching, and thanks to Ultimate Fan for sponsoring. Wherever you are taking in this pod, if you could do all the stuff that helps the podcast grow, like liking, commenting, subscribing, that would be absolutely fantastic. And before we go, don't forget to tell all your friends and all your family about the show. Have a good weekend.